Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. And it has been a strange springtime so far. 2 months of springtime remain, which is a nice thought. We've had a lot of rain, a lot of cold, a lot of wind. Not too much in the wildflower department. I was on the road last week, in part to eulogize my old friend Mojo Nixon down in San Diego, and the hillsides on the way were just covered in poppies and other such bursts of color. Through a lot of Riverside and North San Diego counties. Out here in the desert, it's been pretty scraggly. Other than some nice bunches of my roadside favorites, the desert dandelions. Along the highways and sandy dirt roads, yellow dellos, as they are sometimes called by me. One thing I've rarely seen in these parts is a great big lupine growing in a desert wash where I've often taken my daily walks over these past, how many decades? Too many. Too many years in one place. And the road can't fix that. But when you get away from all the charming people, get out walking by yourself, get out of ear range of the sirens and the monster trucks and the military aircraft. When you're still finding new ways to go this way or that way, even a dreary day can have its moments. Like coming across a big lupine, or being there when the Paris Nolina stalks are just growing out. A dozen years ago, my friend Barney and I sat down alongside a trail with our lunch a little south of here, and we watched the flower plume rising before our eyes. We caught it just in time on the day of ascension. That was probably Bigelow's Nolina with the big, big stalks, 7 or 8 feet tall. It's got one of those funny Latin names that just sounds fake. Which Nolina is that, Barney? The one with the big, big flower plume? I just love that big Nolina. Oh, well, that's the Nolina Bigelovi. Nolina Bigelovi, that's the real name in Latin. But who is Bigelow? Well, it's not Ruth C. Bigelow, who started a tea company in Connecticut in 1945. There's good tea, too, although the name on my usual Earl Grey tea, which I order by the restaurant-sized carton, is Twinings. And it's not Robert Bigelow, the motel magnate out of Las Vegas, who sometimes funds various ghost hunting and flying saucer organizations of dubious everything. It's a name that every field biologist in California should know by heart. John Milton Bigelow. As a doctor and surgeon in the 1800s on a number of important surveys of the American West, and especially along the new U.S.-Mexican border, John Milton Bigelow indulged his particular interest in native plants with medicinal uses. John Milton Bigelow was born to a seventh-generation New England family, but was raised and schooled in Ohio, where he received his medical degree in 1832 and developed his love of botany, ranging over the Ohio River Valley and its rich natural bounty. His survey of Ohio's medicinal plants was the first to be published. Having grown up poor and needing to teach school on the side to pay for college, John Milton Bigelow did not shy away from hard work or from challenges or adventure, which he gladly accepted when the chance came up. So at the age of 46, he signed on as surgeon and botanist for the Mexican Boundary Survey. Following the U.S.-Mexican War that fulfilled the gold-hungry manifest destiny of the Americans, this adventure took him through the Chihuahuan, Sonoran, and Colorado deserts, where he cataloged the great variety of desert plants. Along with a couple of other botanists on the expedition, including C.C. Perry, namesake of Perry's Nolina. The work was so pleasing to Bigelow that he readily accepted the position of botanist on another trek to plot a railroad line between the 35th and 36th parallels. Now, this is from Bigelow's biography by the British Natural History Museum. The Pacific Railroad Expedition followed a line from Fort Smith, Arkansas, to the Mojave Desert in southwestern California, and finally to Los Angeles. Although by far the oldest member of the expedition, Bigelow was a general favorite and was described in the diary of the expedition artist Baldwin Mulhausen as a pattern of gentleness and patience always, never wanting when a hearty laugh or a good joke was to be heard. To his patients, he was kind and attentive. And he made an absolute spoiled child of his mule, Billy. Leaving the party in San Diego at the end of the expedition, Bigelow continued on his own to Northern California and was one of the first botanists to see living stands of Sequoia Dendron Giganteum, the giant sequoias. As the California botanist Willis Lynn Jepson wrote, Bigelow was so fortunate as to view a considerable part of California while its native vegetation was still in nearly pristine freshness. During that beautiful spring of 1854, Bigelow ranged up the coast and across the Central Valley and deep into the Sierra Nevada. A year and a half before Galen Clark, longtime guardian of the Yosemite Grant, first laid eyes on the Mariposa Grove. In all, more than 60 plant species were first collected and described by Dr. Bigelow. He continued to take on botany expeditions well into old age. Settled in Michigan, where he was a founder of the Detroit Academy of Medicine, and was surgeon in charge of the Detroit Marine Hospital until his retirement at age 70 in 1873. It was while working on his farm 4 years later that John Milton Bigelow was fatally injured, passing on at the age of 74, deeply loved by family and friends, well remembered by all the great scientists of his time. What a life.
Desert Oracle Radio.
It's a life that's really free for the taking, too. Instead of looking at video on a screen of somebody else doing something or pretending to do something, you can be the person who does things. Not for a camera, but in real life. It's worth noting that there are no pictures of John Milton Bigelow. Although his scientific colleagues are all represented by either illustrations or photographs. Don't worry, I'm not going to take away your phone camera and your laptop. Not yet. But what if you watched 90% less video on a phone, on a screen, on the TV that now watches you as much as the phone does? As George Orwell foresaw 75 years ago when he published 1984. Some people call it 1984, but that's incorrect. It was supposed to sound cold and clinical and modern, cruelly bureaucratic, constantly humiliating. Like the emails from your health insurance corporation with subject lines like your medical claim journey regarding a life-saving prescription you've been denied by a computer program that denies medical claims in bulk by the thousands. No AI required. Back in the 80s, it was a popular thing to say that Orwell was wrong about the year 1984, but his title was never meant to be an exact prediction. It was just close enough to the book's contemporary readers, yet far enough out from 1949 to work the way it worked on people, on the culture. And it turns out George Orwell, Eric Blair in real life, timed it pretty well because he was in the zone when he wrote that book. He went out to the haunted Scottish Isle of Jura and the Hebrides, and for three seasons, usually from late spring to early autumn, he was in that charged realm of isolation, solitude, and the sea. Sick with the tuberculosis that would kill him a year and a half later. Orwell only settled on his title while pounding out his last draft on that raw Hebridean isle at a farm called Barnhill dating back to the 15th century. No newspapers, no phone, and clean sea air for his ravaged lungs. Poisoned by the pollution of London. A certain kind of book functions as a divination tool, and I've got bookcases full of them. The symbols will resonate in many ways for a long time. And so George Orwell foresaw that 1984 would be the year of the Mac. The Macintosh. Named after a Canadian apple discovered by a Scottish farmer. The new personal computer that would lead directly to the constant surveillance most of us live under every day. While we work, while we sleep, while we do whatever we do with our time. Which is no business of anyone else in a society that has always prized its liberty. Steadily giving it up. From the first Macintosh desktop computer to the first computers with a built-in camera pointed at you, well, that's another 15 years or so. Beyond that year of the Mac, in 1984, when Apple Computer spent a fortune on a Super Bowl commercial that announced the beginning of Big Brother while pretending to be against it. TVs did not watch you until you started watching TV on devices that watch you back. And we did not start carrying those TVs that watch us everywhere we go until the Mac OS became the iPhone OS. So Orwell was right. With Apple Computer bizarrely playing its own mass televised role in the prediction. The apple of 1984 was the apple the Book of Genesis pretends existed in the earthly paradise. And yet, unlike the Book of Genesis, the bummer version of the Garden of Eden ancient story that survived, while happier versions became the realm of archaeology, our fate is not sealed. We are not forever excluded from the earthly paradise. It's still there, and it needs us to make sure it's still there. As the mountaineer Jesus of Galilee said, "The kingdom of heaven is here with us, but people do not see it." Sometimes people get mad because they listen to this broadcast and they don't like something they hear. But that's the mindset of today. If everything and everybody doesn't 100% agree with your worldview, the worldview you got off social media in place of developing your own personality, well, there's gonna be trouble. Over the years, I've come across angry emails, online messages, podcast reviews, whatever form of digital screaming, and sometimes it goes like this. "You think life was better before? Insert whatever terrible corporate military intelligence technology forced into our lives in recent years." My answer, which I never actually provide because one should never talk back to the void of misery, is yes, I think that. For more than three centuries, all the way until the 1940s, my various ancestors were all rural people living in the mountains, the deserts, the forests. They built and owned their plain rustic homes. They were unhindered by telephone and television. They breathed clean air, raised and hunted their own food, traded surplus with neighbors and in nearby towns. Their schools and cemeteries and churches were likewise built and operated by the people in that community. Where a few hundred might be spread over 1,000 square miles. Babies were born at home and people died at home, generally in old age after a full, vigorous life. Their lives were filled with music, not the banality of the algorithm generated by billionaires, but music sung and played by the people themselves. Whistle while you work, raise your voices on Sunday mornings. Bring out the fiddles and flutes and banjos on warm evenings outside. The brass band on holidays, mournful songs at the graveside. Oh, but somebody complains. But they did not have modern medicine. Well, that depends, doesn't it? John Milton Bigelow, whom we talked about a little while ago, was part of the long tradition of materia medica, the term for medicinal cures from the plant world, a term used from the Roman Empire to the 20th century. One of his modern medicines that he developed in Detroit was a particular version of opium that is still pretty popular worldwide, although it's now more often associated with the deaths of despair epidemic, a truly modern epidemic. Only since the 1940s has pharmacology replaced the lovely old Latin materia medica. In those olden times, people died for many reasons. But nobody died waiting for a type 2 diabetes insulin prescription because they couldn't afford it, or because the health insurance network was taken down by ransomware 3 months ago. Deaths of despair, the fastest rising cause of death in 21st century America and much of the industrialized world, were all but unknown outside the filthy, teeming cities where you only lived if you absolutely had to. We've all been sold a false bill of goods regarding the discoveries of penicillin and antibiotics and all that. Yes, they were great discoveries by brilliant scientists who never tired of learning from the natural processes of nature, of biology. And yes, they were of great use once humanity became increasingly penned up into filthy, dehumanizing tenements and poorhouses, the first fruits of the Industrial Revolution. But the outright fiction that humans and our bipedal brothers were helpless in the face of common infection has poisoned our minds like the microplastics and forever chemicals lodged in our brains today. Humans and our close relatives over these past 3 million years have always treated sickness from the same natural bounty that fed, clothed, and housed us. More than half of all the drugs you wait in line for at the Walgreens are derived from ancient cures that the local healer would have concocted from trees and herbs and cactus and minerals like countless generations before. It's why the world's immensely profitable big pharma companies are unlikely champions of saving at least some biodiverse wilderness. From the Amazonian jungles and Malaysian isles to the Siberian forest and Mexican deserts. Tomorrow's supposed new medical discovery is usually an ancient cure that people have forgotten about, as they were pushed out of the natural world and into the artificial everything debt prisons of modern life. And the very miracle cures from Louis Pasteur on down have turned into a sick nightmare in less than a century of widespread use. Bacterial infections, once controlled with little more than clean air and pure water and wild honey packed over a wound, have become Dr. Frankenstein's superbugs. Impossible to control. Untreatable. Resistant to the harshest antibiotics the industry can synthesize. When you spend a lifetime eating factory-produced meat and eggs and dairy pump full of antibiotics to fight the filth and misery the animals live out their pathetic lives imprisoned within, then common infections and once rare conditions become common killers. Before the nightmare became daylight reality for most of us less than a century ago, at the time when the sickened George Orwell typed his masterpiece between bloody fits of coughing, few people ever stepped foot into a doctor's office or were rolled into an operating room to have limbs amputated due to epidemic type 2 diabetes, which was all but unknown. This is from a 2016 study of pre-industrial chronic disease from the National Institutes of Health. Quote, converging evidence suggests that hunter-gatherers, horticulturalists, and agropastoralists living under relatively traditional conditions do not experience coronary artery disease or type 2 diabetes. It is unlikely that clinically relevant heart disease and type 2 diabetes were ever frequent causes of morbidity and mortality among older adults in pre-industrialized societies. Lifestyle factors such as lean, high-fiber diets, free of processed foods, higher levels of physical activity, minimal smoking, and other behaviors are protective factors common to many pre-industrial societies. Infant and childhood mortality was always high in pre-industrial society. The Amish in 18th century America were typical, losing about 1 in 5 children to infections and illness and birth defects. Today, as diverse and cascading factors from BPA contamination of sperm to childcare being unaffordable to all but the highest earners, has sent human fertility plummeting to levels never before seen in the human race. Instead of 4 in 5 of your children surviving to adulthood, or even half your children surviving to adulthood and old age, you can't afford to have any children. And the world is so demeaning and depressing that most young people don't want to have children. They think it's their own decision, although E.O. Wilson could set them straight. The book is called On Human Nature, if you're interested. So the rich have 2 beautiful kids carefully raised to get 20 years of increasingly expensive schooling where any free-thinking protest behavior is dealt with in truly Orwellian fashion. And then the well-trained offspring are put behind desk on Wall Street 5 days a week between 48-hour cocaine binges with hookers on yachts. The lifespan of an American has barely risen above that in the Old Testament, supposedly the story of Bronze Age pastoralists 5 millennia ago, 70 years. From Amboy to Zyzix, across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I'm Ken Lane with soundscapes on this program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I'm sorry the April campfire stories never happened, and all the other things that were supposed to happen around here. There's a malevolent force around here, no use sugarcoating it, and I'm done trying. The next campfire stories will be, as I've mentioned, in the Eastern Sierra, for just a handful of you who might be up there. Details to come in time. Don't get nervous about it. Don't get nervous about anything like this. Just don't worry about it. And don't worry, I'm not going to take away your spreadsheets and your video conferences. I leave that to the forces already at work, already taking down global infrastructure, its poisoned heart and crumbling bones. Be of good cheer. The military-industrial state will soon collapse. I used to laugh at that, at Abby's line from down the river. I'm not laughing anymore. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.